6 above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war.
And welcome to this Wednesday edition of A Public Affair. I'm John Quinlan, guest hosting today. Most of you know that now I've got a regular gig on Mondays, and we hope you'll be joining us this next Monday as we have an election special, also a preview of the Wisconsin Book Festival. Today, got a very special show, one I've been looking forward to for some time, and this is connected to the Wisconsin Book Festival. Coming up a week from tonight, Amitabh Paul, who is my guest in studio, the author of Islam Means Peace, Understanding the Muslim Principle of Nonviolence Today, will be speaking at the Wisconsin Book Festival. And so we are really looking forward to hearing more about this book that was published back in 2011 and how that will play out at the book festival. And, you know, obviously very topical in terms of recent foreign policy debates, the president's race, how Islamophobia, I think, influences our outlook on the world, how in a post-9/11 world Islam has often been conflated with violence and with other things that really aren't central to what the meaning is behind this great faith. And Amit has just some wonderful examples taken worldwide of how this plays itself out. So again, just in a moment, Amitabh Paul with Islam Means Peace. But before we get started, we have a very special guest on the line, someone that kind of came roundabout through some of the same connections we made with you, Amit. Esther, we have a guest from out in New York. Esther Heinemann is with us, and she is coming to Madison, we hope, weather conditions permitting, to speak about a very important project she's involved with in Afghanistan, working with young women in education. Esther, welcome to A Public Affair.
Thanks, John. Happy to be here.
Glad you could be here. So could you just tell us the basics? What is the name of your organization and kind of what is its history and mission?
Sure. I'm on the board of an organization called Women for Afghan Women. People listening in, if they're interested, can turn to the website, www.womenforafghanwomen.org. This is a women's human rights organization. It's a grassroots organization with multiple projects in Afghanistan. We work to access justice for women in the country. We have eight shelters, eight family guidance centers in eight different provinces, and we're expanding even further. And we have a facility in Kabul called the Halfway House, which helps women who are transitioning from shelters and also from prison get on their feet and start a new life. We have big training programs for them so they can learn how to live independently. And we have a facility called the Children's Support Center. In fact, we have three of these now. We take children who have been living with mothers in prison, and we bring them to these model residences. We have a very advanced learning program for them. The reason I'm very happy to talk to your listeners because there's a misunderstanding, I think fostered by the press throughout the country, that no progress has been made on women's rights in Afghanistan, and this is far from the truth. There are a minimum of 14 shelters for women in Afghanistan. That's great progress in a short time. And we employ lawyers in all of our facilities to defend women in court. So it's very important that people in the United States really understand that the majority of people in Afghanistan are in favor of women's rights. We hear only the horrible stories that a media addicted to sensationalism broadcast, but we help women. We've helped over 6,000 women since we started in 2005.
No, it sounds like very valuable, very fascinating work. What is the intersection with what you do in terms of encouraging the education of young women?
Well, we teach in all of our facilities. We have educational programs, literacy programs. Most of our clients come to us having never been in school. We have teachers in all our family guidance centers. And women are hungry to learn. They attend our classes. We also have, along with literacy classes, we have Islamic studies classes, because people in Afghanistan, the majority of them, especially those who have never been to school, are totally ignorant of what women's rights are in Islam. They've been lied to, and the brutal treatment of women is very far from Islamic thought. Islam preaches harmonious family relationships. We work with mullahs all the time to get this message out. And so that's the Islamic studies classes are a very important part of our program. And we're also trying to start new education programs for women and girls in areas where progress has been a little slow.
You'll have to help me. Actually, Ahmed, maybe you can help me. The young woman in Pakistan.
Malala Yousafzai.
Yeah, I wanted to just bring her in. I know, Esther, as we were talking last night, one of the things you impressed on me is, of course, this story is so important. It's so important for us to hear in the West and for it to have achieved bringing people together in Pakistan. But you were, I think, impressing on me that it's a story that is replicated in other ways. There are many young, courageous women who are advocating on behalf of women's rights, on behalf of the right to education. And you run into them in the course of your work every day. Is that right?
Absolutely. And we employ in Afghanistan 430 local Afghans. When I'm in Afghanistan, I'm the only non-Afghan working with the organization. And every single one of these people is risking his or her life to bring women's rights throughout the country. And it's very important that people understand this. There's a sort of difference between what happened to Malala and our clients, because most of our clients are attacked by family members, whereas she was attacked for political reasons, really. And I want to point out, people, that the Taliban are not promulgating Islam. They hide behind Islam. They hide behind a false picture of Islam. But what they're really doing is carrying out their strategy to gain control of Afghanistan. They're terrorizing people. They're terrorists, and they want control of the country, and they'll stop at nothing to get it. The Taliban pretend to be religious and very pious, but in fact, they're the opposite.
Oh, interesting point. Once again, could you tell us how folks can find out more about the organization and what are ways that people can support the work that you're doing?
Well, you can go on the Internet. We have a website, it's www.womenforafghanwomen.org. That's O-R-G for organization. And you can see, you can read information about all of our programs, a lot of details that I didn't have time to talk about today. And there is a place on the website where you can donate to the organization. And we depend on individual donations to run all our programs.
All right. Well, again, we'll make arrangements to have you back on the show where we can talk about this in greater length. Are you going to be able to get out of LaGuardia today?
No, I'm not going to LaGuardia. I'm going to JFK. I think LaGuardia is closed.
Yeah, that's what I'd heard.
I think I'm one of the lucky few who's getting out of New York. New York is a disaster area, really.
Yeah.
But I think I'm going to get on a plane and get out. So I'll be in Madison, and I would love to talk to you, John, further. and Amitabh also. I think we have similar ideas to discuss. It would be really interesting. So thank you very much for having me on the program.
Thank you so much for being on.
Yeah, no, we're glad to help facilitate those connections when you arrive here. So you're speaking at the university. I know because you're pinch-hitting, you were a little uncertain about exactly which settings and other things. But I know you're speaking, among other things, to a women's studies class and to a larger group of students later on.
That's right. I'm pretty sure now I'm going to get there. So
okay.
I hope I do. I love to speak to college students, and I'll be there for 4 days. So. Thanks again, John, and we'll talk in the future.
All right, give me a call if you have just a break in between things this week, and we'll see. Maybe we can even make some connections this week for you.
All right, that would be great. I'll definitely call you.
All right.
Take care, and thanks again.
Thank you. All right, safe travels. Bye-bye. Once again, for those of you who are joining us in midstream, this is A Public Affair, our Wednesday edition. I'm your host for today, John Quinlan. I just didn't mention one change that's happening. Many of you listen in on Wednesdays now for Brenda Conkle, who has been a longtime host on various days. Brenda, I think for various reasons, is pulling back now, given the scope of her work in the community and everything. But we are trying to set things up so she'll be a regular guest on my show, probably on the first Monday of every week, and still be able to do the fantastic job she does of reporting on local government and activism in all kinds of different forms. So anyway, that's upcoming. And again, please do tune in this Monday on my regular show. In this case, we'll have a very special Election Day edition, coupled also with a preview of the Wisconsin Book Festival, which starts 2 days after that. There is life after the election, rumor has it. But speaking right now with Amitabh Paul, who I'll refer to from now on as Amit, and he is the author of Islam Means Peace, Understanding the Muslim Principle of Nonviolence Today. WisconsinBookFestival.org is a place that you can find out more generally about the different features. But Amit, do you have some details on the panel that you'll be appearing on?
So yes, John, thanks for bringing that up
and
making a plug for that. So it's 5:30 Wednesday evening, next Wednesday, the 7th. And I'll be on with Ayad Akhtar, who is a Pakistani-American novelist, has written a wonderful novel just recently. And also Professor Charles Cohen, who's here at the University of Wisconsin and is also the director of the Lubar Institute for the Study of Abrahamic Faiths. I'm probably mangling the name a bit. But, you know, it deals with Christianity, Judaism, and Islam.
Wow.
And I have actually, they invited me earlier this year to speak in an event that was put together by their institute, and now he's the moderator for the event. So again, it's Wednesday, next Wednesday at 5:30 at the Overture Center.
I believe it's again Promenade Hall, I think.
Yes.
This is the
yes.
exact location. Again, WisconsinBookFestival.org is a place you can find out more about this, and do tune in on Monday. Again, we'll have kind of a more sweeping overview of all the different programs that are happening this year. And, well, just to get started with this, is a look at the foreword to the book. I should say in passing that trying to describe your bio is probably one of the more challenging jobs that you ever had. You were born in Germany. You said your father was a shipbuilder and that your travels took you all over, as well as spending some time in the States growing up. But also grew up in large part in north central India in the province of Uttar Pradesh, in and near a city.
Which, if it was a country, John, would be the fifth largest country in the world. It has 200 million people, that one state in India.
If you look at population density maps, that's where all the red dots
exactly,
are all clumped
exactly.
together.
Yeah.
So a fascinating place. And we've discovered in passing, my mother grew up, spent 4 years not far away in the city of Kanpur. Those of you who know Lee Brown, who was a local peace activist for many years, she actually lived in Lucknow. Joe Elder, who's a professor at the university, had a year there, and now you have an intern who said he's spending time there. So Lucknow, sort of the center of the world. But as you reflect back in your forward to the book and growing up in that area, you talk about your family is not of the Islamic faith. It was more of a Hindu.
Yes, the Hindus. Yes,
and so for you. Growing up, Ramadan, though, was a time of celebration and a time when your Islamic neighbors essentially delivered gifts and helped bring you into that celebration. Is that right?
Very much so. And, you know, and Lucknow is, in fact, one of the people I mentioned in the book, Azad, who Maulana Azad, who was worked with Gandhi, was the president of the Congress Party, and became India's education minister after independence, referred to that culture as a Ganga-Yamuna culture. In other words, the confluence of Islam and Hinduism. And there is perhaps no better city to illustrate this than the city where I spent my early school years and then again college, and that's the city of Lucknow, which is the capital of the state of Uttar Pradesh. And very, very diverse city, multi-faith in the best way. And our own neighborhood was such a microcosm of this. On one side, there were Hindu neighbors. On the other side, Christian. And just across a narrow walkway, there was a Muslim, a member of Muslim royalty, no less.
Wow.
Who actually owned the entire compound and had sold our house to my grandparents. So it was quite incredible. And yes, during Ramadan, he used to send over, you know, lovely food during that month. And I still remember that with extreme fondness.
You know, as I was explaining, back in 1989, my mom and I ventured back for what was a return trip for her to India. And Lucknow was our headquarters for about 5 or 6 days. And yeah, just remembering the beauty of the mosques and, you know, Islamic culture just permeates the place in a really wonderful way.
Yes, yes, absolutely so. And another remarkable thing about Lucknow, contrary to stereotypes that wherever Muslims in India are in larger numbers, there is discord, there are riots. It's almost been almost completely riot-free for the last many, many decades. It's really an example of sort of harmonious coexistence between Hindus and Muslims, and then, of course, Christians and Sikhs in smaller numbers, too.
Yeah, you know, it strikes me as a general observation. Folks often point to the United States as this unique example of pluralism in action in a country of many diverse potential factions that somehow comes together. And even though we're a little cynical about things right at the moment, you know, more or less works. But India is such a marvelous model for that as well.
Oh, yes. I mean, it'd be hard to find a country more heterogeneous than India. I mean, in terms of ethnic diversity, religious diversity, racial diversity. I mean, really, it's just quite remarkable. I mean, the varied sort of, you know, landscapes, human landscapes, all the way from Kashmir in the north to the south, and then you get to the northeast where the people are of the same sort of racial mix as the Burmese and the Tibetans, so that becomes an entirely different sort of area of India. It's just quite remarkable.
Well, what we want to touch on throughout the hour are just some of the misconceptions and misunderstandings that people have. You know, it's interesting, again, in that example in the foreword, just the whole example of someone of the Islamic faith kind of sharing that experience and sharing in the joy and the celebration with yourself, in this case, not someone who is Islamic. And, you know, I think that goes against a notion that sometimes we have that Islamic people are very segregated from the rest of the societies in which they live and everything, but that's really not the case, is it?
No, I mean, you know, this is not to sort of, you know, completely oversimplify.
Sure.
And you know, I'm sure that does exist at you know, in many instances, but in very many other instances it doesn't. And that's the remarkable thing about India, that on a day-to-day basis people live, work, and sort of, you know, get along nearly completely. You know, the rioting and the violence are big anomaly. The last big instance was 10 years ago in the state of Gujarat, which I've written about a lot. But after that, really, there have been a few instances, but nothing on that scale, at least. And, you know, and people sort of, you know, do exactly their friends, their neighbors. And for the most part, you know, religion doesn't come in between.
Gujarat was the home state of Gandhi.
Ironically,
right?
Of Gandhi, yes.
Yeah. We'll touch on that later. I had a housemate until recently from Gujarat, so
sure,
I learned a lot about that.
Sure.
So again, in terms of some of the stereotypes, you know, the notion is that Muslim equals Arab, and in terms of the heterogeneity, the geographical breadth of where Islamic people, you know, tend to settle, and you know, where their majority culture, that's just not the case, is it?
There's a remarkable sort of diversity of even among even for Muslim majority countries. So this is all the way from Eastern Europe, Albania and Kosovo, to Indonesia and Malaysia in Southeast Asia. And Arabs only constitute about between a fourth and a fifth of Muslims. Again, very much contrary to what you know, what most Americans think. And among the largest concentrations of Muslims are in Pakistan, in India, and Bangladesh.
And then extend as well far to the east. I mean, around across North Africa.
Absolutely. Yeah. All across North Africa, from the western edge, you know, Morocco, all the way out east, and then further all the way down south to Senegal. Nigeria is 50% Muslim. Sierra Leone. So it's really quite a remarkable heterogeneity. And again, here I'm talking just about Muslim majority countries, and of course, you know, we have now millions of Muslims in the United States, millions in Europe, and in nearly all other places around the world.
Do you know the figure right now in the States?
It's a bit disputed, John. The Pew Research Center came out with a figure of about 2 million. Muslim advocacy groups say that that's low, that is closer to between 5 and 6 million. So there's a bit of a sort of a dispute over there about what the exact numbers are.
In terms of places in the United States where there may be larger Muslim American communities, I know Detroit area, Dearborn, Michigan,
is
one.
Yes, very much so. So that has had historically a very large Arab immigrant population, Christian and Muslim. So you're right. I mean, that is definitely one major center. And then, of course, the other big urban metro areas, New York, New Jersey, Chicago here in the Midwest, California. So those are the other sort of, you know, major concentrations of Muslim populations.
But as we become more and more aware, mosques are in virtually every medium and large city, you know, across the South, across the whole of the country. Some of that tension, unfortunately, has you know, and new awareness has come out of incidents of hate crimes and other things.
Yes, I was going to say that. Yeah.
And of course, some of that centered around the building of a mosque. In Lower Manhattan, you know, near Ground Zero, and then precipitated out across the country, what's your analysis of that? Let's start with New York, if we could. Is there anything to be said for the notion that maybe strategically or otherwise that was an unwise decision, or you know, or do we take people at face value that there is this multicultural, multi-faith center that's been established, at which Islam is an important part, that you know, it's probably a valuable place for it to be?
My response to that, John, is, well, A, it wasn't at Ground Zero. It was a few blocks away.
Right.
And B, my response is, if not there, where do you stop? You know, what's the radius?
Yeah.
You know, exactly. And New York itself, New York City itself is so densely populated. And would you place the entire city off limits, the biggest city in this country? I mean, where do you stop? How many blocks from the World Trade Center just because those guys were following a distorted sort of extremist version of Islam? Is it not right to get an interfaith Islamic center headed by a Sufi, no less, you know, built somewhere near there? I mean, that to me is an extremely sort of disturbing assertion to make, that, you know, just because it's a few blocks away, that, you know, nothing connected with Islam should be allowed there.
So Sufism, one of the sects of Islam that is most identified purely with faith. I mean, with peace, rather.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, and there is such a misunderstanding of Sufism in the United States. Either people think it's some sort of an far-out, groovy hippie cult, which has little to do with Islam, or they think, at best, that, you know, it is a minor fringe element of Islam. Both are very, very far from the truth. Sufism is derived from Islam itself. They see the Prophet Muhammad as a non-violent figure, pretty much. And they add upon basically the basic tenets of Islam by having this notion of ihsan, or, you know, sort of, you know, bringing about beauty in the world by doing beautiful things, by spreading a message of peace, by charity. And, you know, South Asian and Southeast Asian Islam especially, but also Islam in the Balkans, Islam in Central Asia, I would say anywhere outside the Arabian Peninsula, has been strongly influenced by Sufism. Rumi, of course, you know, is a major sort of Sufi figure, and he was in Iran.
You know, another example of, I think, you know, public attitudes in this country that are maybe applied inconsistently is, we think back to the Oklahoma City bombing, and the immediate speculation was this had to be an Islamic terrorist.
Yeah.
And the reality was, I'm not quite sure exactly what the faith was of the person, but it's probably more likely that we'd be talking about an extremist Christian who would perpetuate domestic violence or anything. I mean, is there a double standard here?
Well, absolutely, John. And, you know, I mean, I was sharing this with you before the program began. And here's a conversation from early 2003, and perhaps listeners can try to guess who's saying this and in what context. Jacques, you and I share a common faith. You're Roman Catholic, I'm Methodist, but we are both Christians committed to the teachings of the Bible. We share one common Lord. Biblical prophecies are being fulfilled. This confrontation is being willed by God, who wants to use this conflict to erase his people's enemies before a new age begins. And that's our very own President George W. Bush allegedly saying this to Jacques Chirac, the then President of France, about the Iraq War. So, you know, I mean, yeah. you know, faith can be used or misused in so many ways, and to single out Islam, I think, is so unfair. Another sort of, you know, anecdote I have, Gandhi reinterpreted the Gita, the Hindu holy book, in such a wonderfully nonviolent way. His assassins, Nathuram Godse and Apte, went to the gallows happily carrying a copy of the same book with them.
Hmm.
So it's really fascinating. People say I am sort of, you know, my aim is not to whitewash Islam. My aim is to show that Islam can be used in a peaceful, progressive, inclusive, harmonious way, and has been in history, as, you know, have Christianity and Hinduism and Buddhism in sort of, you know, in the exact reverse way. So it's, as I said, it's unfair to single out Islam as people do so.
For those of you joining us midstream here again, we're speaking with Amitabh Paul. He is the author of Islam Means Peace, Understanding the Muslim Principle of Nonviolence Today. And as we noted, he'll be speaking on a interfaith panel, essentially, a week from today, 5:30, as part of the Wisconsin Book Festival at Overture Hall. Maybe I'm mischaracterizing the panel.
It's about, I think it'll focus more on Islam.
Okay.
Although you're right, all three of us on the panel are from different faith traditions.
So
yeah. But I think it'll be focusing more on Islam, yes.
Well, you're mentioning in the Bush quote, this notion that, you know, within Christianity that somehow there's an affinity, there's something binding together. But there's an irony, whether we're talking about the Middle East or other places. Islam is one of three Abrahamic religions.
Yes.
And so there's a real commonality between Islam and Christianity, for example.
Oh, very much so. And, you know, and Muslims have seen Jesus as a prophet. They see Christians and Jews as people of the book. Now, of course, you know, in practice, the treatments of Jews and Christians has been mixed depending on who's been ruling and which country it is. It's ranged from active cooperation to conflict, to sometimes persecution, to, you know, a real sort of, you know, cultural intermixing. If people are interested in a book specifically on Muslim history in Andalusia, which was this region of Spain where there's this remarkable cultural flowering during what was called the Dark Ages in the rest of Europe. It deals with the Ottomans, with Arab history. It's called Peace Be Upon You by Zachary Carabel. And it's one of the books I use as a source for my book. And it just shows in the amazing way that Muslim rulers interacted with Christians and Jews. And this led to this cultural sort of remarkable sort of cultural renaissance in, as I said, you know, in Spain and other places during a time when much of Europe was almost literally in the Dark Ages.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think I mentioned this at the outset either. 608-256-2001. 256-2001 is the number where you can join in our conversation with Amitabh Paul, author of Islam Means Peace, Understanding the Muslim Principle of Nonviolence Today. Just a flashback, we started to talk about the New York incidents, and I think about, I'm trying to remember where it was, where a mosque was burned down, I think Kentucky or Tennessee.
Tennessee, yes.
Tennessee. You know, so many of the reactions they showed, people testifying at public hearings, I'm conflating this with another incident where they were going to build a large mosque, and people were saying, we should have brought into this. How can you ask us to do this? And there were all these connections made with as if somehow Muslim people collectively were responsible for 9/11. And how could we do this? And how could we compound the outrage and the trauma of the victims of 9/11 by having a mosque?
Yeah.
How do you answer folks who think like that?
It's quite remarkable to me that people think of all Muslims collectively acting together, you know, when in this country, you know, they've come from such different backgrounds. And of course, there's a large contingent of African-American Muslims.
Yeah.
And, you know, how do you sort of, you know, how do you sort of, how do you account for their role in this supposed vast conspiracy? And, you know, I mean, they think of Muslims in the Islam in the abstract. most, you know, the remarkable recent poll, Time Magazine poll, 2010, 2 years ago, 62% of Americans say they have never met a Muslim.
Hmm.
So almost two-thirds of Americans have never met a Muslim, and yet have all these images of Islam, stereotypical images taken from media coverage, which they use to guide their response toward that religion and its followers.
I kind of wonder if there's resonance there with a similar statistic about gay people, and maybe they have met someone who is Muslim or, you know, or gay in this case, and just don't realize too,
absolutely.
Which was part of it. We have a couple of callers on the line, so let's get to our first call if we could. Your comment or question, please, for Ahmadine Paul.
I wonder if in your program you talk about the very beginning of Islamic religion, because the messenger, Muhammad, was this incredible peacemaker. Before him, the giant peninsula of Arabia was traditionally overrun with violence, revenge killing, honor killing, what all. In about 10 years, he established this polity of Islam with about 90-95% diplomacy and a little bit of military, in which peace flourished. It was a kind of amazing thing to do in a decade that you could pacify that long ago this gigantic chunk of the planet.
No, that's a great point.
Well, I'm so glad. I mean, thank you so much, caller. I mean, you know, the part of the demonization of Islam in the West is the vilification of the Prophet Muhammad. And a good part of vilification that's directed toward him is this notion that unlike Jesus or the Buddha, maybe, that he was primarily a violent figure and that he spent his life mainly sort of, you know, subjugating his enemies and spreading Islam by the sword. And that's such a calumny, as the caller pointed out, that, you know, his phase in Mecca was completely peaceful. For 12, 13 years, he basically preached Islam peacefully, responded to all the provocations, all the physical and mental abuse heaped upon him and his followers peacefully. His emigration to Medina was a peaceful gesture, which is hallowed in Islam. After that, the Medina phase becomes a bit more complicated, but the violence he used was defensive. He was primarily a peacemaker. Even non-Muslim historians have said that. There are wonderful quotes I have in my book about, you know, his life. And by Annie Besant, who was actually involved in the Indian freedom struggle too, who says, "Never a wrong done to him that he did not forgive, never an injury that he was not ready to pardon." And Karen Armstrong, who actually I was so delighted to meet recently, an ex-nun, who's perhaps the foremost comparative religionist alive today, really. Yeah. I mean, at least among the most popular. And she's written a biography of Muhammad. She's written a history of Islam. She says, "The traditional biographies make it clear that even though the first Ummah, the first Muslim community, had to fight in order to survive, Muhammad did not achieve victory by the sword, but by a creative and ingenious policy of nonviolence." So, you know, exactly. And there's such a misconception in the West that he was a person sort of you went about brandishing the sword, attacking people, and the way Islam was spread was primarily, if not completely, by violent means.
This reminds me of a conversation we had. We had a panel in the days after the incident in Oak Creek at the Sikh temple,
sure.
Talking about that tradition, which is a distinctly different tradition, and yet one of the commonalities here is that they also define themselves as based on traditions of peace from the very origins of the religion. But I think the only distinction they make is that they also sort of the champions of the underdog. They go out again, you know, as you're talking about Islam in terms of where violence does manifest, it's often in a defensive mode. And so anyway, it puts it in a different context in terms of still coming back to this basic underlying concept of nonviolence.
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of precepts, and I'm familiar with the Sikh religion too, that they took were taken from Islam. So Sikhism in some ways tried to synthesize the best of Hinduism and Islam while doing away with sort of, you know, the bad aspects of both religions. So exactly, equality, the notion of social justice and equality was heavily taken. I don't want to say borrowed, that maybe sort of, you know, but, you know, so certainly they took it and they sort of made it as central a part of their faith as it is of Islam.
Absolutely. 608-256-2001 is the number if you'd like to join our conversation. And we do have a couple of other callers online. Call your comment or question, please.
Yes. My experience is that Muslim and Christian and Jew are used collectively, and what that really means is there's a great variety of groups, but when I talk to individuals, they don't, I think, fall into any particular group. They have their own understanding of what their Islam or Judaism means to them. It's when they become unified as something called a people that they become violent, and then you have the Ottoman Empire and the Christian Crusades, and you had the Jewish efforts today in Israel. How do we keep that collective violence from taking over the meaning of basically what's an individual experience?
How much, Paul?
Yes, I'm so glad that you brought that up, because the biggest libel against Muslims is that the Quran preaches violence. And even that, as I've shown, is quite incorrect. There are passages in the Quran enjoining Muslims to work for peace, to be harmonious in their relations with other religions, etc., etc. And I've given again and again these examples that violence is only permitted as in a very defensive mode as a last resort. But also, caller, you do make an important distinction between textual religion and lived religion. So in other words, you know, people, when they live in their sort of, you know, individual capacities, sort of on a day-to-day basis, it's not like, you know, every Muslim gets up and says, I have to follow the Quran down to the last letter. I mean, that's not possible. So you're right. I mean, you know, of course, you know, people compromise, so to speak. People try to, you know, get along. People try to sort of, you know, have good relations with their neighbors, regardless of what their religious or ethnic background is. So in that sense, of course, you know, I mean, you know, people have their own, each individual has his or her own understanding of Islam or Christianity or Judaism. And you're right, it's only perhaps when they are exhorted to form a collective that violence creeps in. Absolutely.
Thank you, caller. When we talk about nonviolence, I think many of us associate that with Gandhi and Hindu traditions, or with the Black Civil Rights era here, or with Quaker meeting, or anyway, a number of different things, but don't always necessarily follow it back to its Islamic roots. And one of the powerful things about your book are the several, numerous cogent examples in different parts of the world, how this plays itself out. Let me start, if I could, in Eastern Europe, in the context of Kosovo, Albania. While we think of the wars and some of the conflicts that happened there post-fall of the Berlin Wall, nonviolent action was actually a part of the changes that were occurring there as well. Is that right?
Absolutely, John. This was the most underreported story of the 1990s from the Balkans, this remarkable non-cooperation movement headed by Ibrahim Rugova, who was called the Gandhi of the Balkans, who basically, in a protest against the persecution by Slobodan Milosevic, who of course became globally infamous, the leader of Serbia / Yugoslavia, they set up a parallel system of schools and hospitals and other sort of, you know, social and cultural institutions for pretty much a decade, and they were successful. Unfortunately, and this is how, you know, media coverage influences outcomes, it received, you know, a fraction of the coverage of more violent sort of, you know, alternatives in Kosovo and outside, and all the wars raging. So in the end, they pretty much had to give up because there was, you know, little outside support. But this was, again, an extremely underreported story out of that region.
To flash to South Asia, the context of Pakistan, drawing Musharraf and drawing out some of the folks who... anyway, trying to make sense there and trying to return to more a responsive democratic government. There were nonviolent protest movements that were primarily Islamic that were involved there.
Yes, John. And we're talking about very recent history. So this is 2006 to 2008.
Yeah.
1999, General Pervez Musharraf came to power in Pakistan. Pakistan has been plagued by generals and coups. The joke goes there that it's an army that has a country rather than the other way around. So he came. He was the latest incarnation. Came to power in 1999. Initially, he had some support, but of course, started growing more and more authoritarian. Removed the Chief Justice of Pakistan, just completely dismissed him, extremely high-handedly one day. And in response, civil society in Pakistan, led by lawyers, mounted this really brave protest movement against Pervez Musharraf. And Musharraf did not respond with a light touch, let me assure you.
Yeah.
In one instance in Karachi, the largest city in Pakistan, in order to maintain deniability, he let his local allies lose on the lawyers, while the army and the police completely stood by. 40 people were killed. Mm. I mean, just incredible, absolutely. And yet the lawyers kept on persisting. He had a state of emergency. In the end, he was so cornered, he and the Bush administration, which loved him, that they had to call elections. He was hoping he'd win that. He lost badly. And now sort of he finally gave up the ghost. And he's now sitting in England, basically hoping for a comeback. But, you know, that's not likely. So Pakistan is a democratic country again, flawed, with problems, but definitely a democracy again.
608-256-2001 is the number if you'd like to join in our conversation with Amitabh Paul, author of Islam Means Peace, Understanding the Muslim Principle of Nonviolence Today. In the realm of misconceptions, David Attenborough's film Gandhi, while it is certainly worthy of considering, there are critiques that need to be made there. And I think one is that Gandhi and Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who becomes the first president of Pakistan, are set against each other. Certainly there was conflict there. And yet Islamic people were very much at the center of the struggle for nonviolence that Gandhi was a part of.
Yes, John. And, you know, in doing that, Attenborough, and much as I love the film, was basically reflecting, sadly, these misconceptions in India also, among a lot of people in India, because Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who founded Pakistan and who had this very different vision for Muslims in the subcontinent, he thought that they deserved a separate country. There's a bit of debate as to exactly what he wanted, but in the end he had Pakistan, which was West and East Pakistan, which later became Bangladesh. It's often overlooked as to how many Muslims were with Gandhi, working alongside Gandhi, and in the same spirit, in the best tradition of pluralism, tolerance, and nonviolence. Remarkable. And the most remarkable of these figures was in the region of Pakistan that's now synonymous with terrorism and violence. His name was Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan, known as the Frontier Gandhi. And he led a non-violent movement of 100,000 Pashtuns. I'm not making this up. 100,000 Pashtuns dedicated to religious tolerance, women's rights, social justice, and overthrowing the British by non-violent means. Mm. And there were many, many others. Maulana Azad, I mentioned. Zakir Hussain became the president of India in the 1960s. And a host of others who are quite well-known in India, but almost unknown outside India.
Let's flash ahead to the 1980s, the Intifada, which was a reaction of Palestinian people within Palestine. I think at that point, just convinced that things were going nowhere and something needed to happen in order for them to be able to assert their rights after living under occupation for so long. Again, our association so much about all things in the Middle East, the stereotypes of Palestinians as equaling terrorists, unfortunately, and other things. You know, cloud our ability to understand that so much of what the Palestinian rights movement and all is about is based in nonviolence, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, John. The first Intifada, which was from the late 80s to early 90s, was primarily, and of course, you know, I'll say here primarily, a nonviolent movement.
Yeah.
It was consisting mainly of marches, of strikes, including tax boycotts, of tax rebellions, of hunger strikes, of collective actions of one sort or the other. Included in this, however, was stone throwing. Now, even among scholars of nonviolence and nonviolence strategists, you know, there is this debate about whether stone throwing is purely nonviolent. Is it violence? Is it somewhere in the middle? But that was the primary sort of exhibition of violence, along with the, sadly, with the killing of some people, some Palestinians, interestingly, who were considered collaborators. But there was almost no lethal violence directed toward the Israelis in the first intifada from the late 80s to the early 90s. Sadly, the second intifada was quite a different ballgame. But even within that, there was a strain of nonviolence. To this day, there are weekly protests in villages around Palestine, such as Bilin, Budrus, etc., against the separation barrier that has confiscated so much of Palestinian land. People ranging from Jimmy Carter to Desmond Tutu to Mahatma Gandhi's grandson have gone there and taken part in those demonstrations in expressions of solidarity, and they certainly wouldn't if these demonstrations were violent.
As you talk about this, you talk about it partly in the context of the work of Mubarak Awad, who is someone who is actually now an American citizen. I think strategically or why nonviolent means of doing things makes sense is so well captured in that instance, because it gives the folks who are seen initially as your enemies, your opponents, the opportunity to understand and to join in and to become part of what you're doing. As Gandhi described it too, it's moving beyond a polarization where someone is always on the opposite side or the other and giving them a chance.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it changed public opinion in Israel. I think it changed global public opinion. I mean, I was in college at the time, and I remember sort of being so outraged by this. I mean, what the PLO, etc., by their violent tactics were not able to do, it unnerved the Israeli leadership. Yeah. It brought them to the negotiation table. I mean, really. So, I mean, even this, it wasn't purely nonviolent, and even then it had so much success. It was quite remarkable.
It also brought together, I think there was this myth that there were different factions that could never work together, and yet under the mantle of nonviolence, people did come together.
Absolutely. Christians and Muslims, different factions of the Palestinian movement, within the PLO, outside the PLO, it was quite remarkable.
All right. 256-2001, this is probably your last chance if you do want to join us so that we can get some back and forth here. But we do have another caller on the line. Your comment or question, please.
Thank you. This is a very interesting conversation. Somehow or another, the timeline has been extremely distorted. Christianity is the greatest. Those who profess Christianity currently are the greatest mass murderers on this planet at this particular time. And to use another religion to hide that fact that Americans currently, as a matter of fact, are the greatest mass murderers currently of all time. And a religion, your religion really has nothing to do with it. Americans will kill you in the name of God, and I am a honorably discharged United States Marine Corps veteran with more confirmed kills than you got for landing. And you really need to understand that about this place. And I would like to just thank you for this opportunity to allow for that information to be put out there. Thank you very
much. Thank you, caller. Ahmed, your response?
all religions have had their share of killings.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, the Inquisition in Europe, the Portuguese and Spanish conquest, especially of Latin America. And then, it's disturbing this religious aspect of the Iraq War, which is not, you know, ancient history. I mean,
right.
Even if religion played a small part in it, we are talking about, the deaths of possibly hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq. So, absolutely, I mean, I'm not sure if I'd quite go as far as the caller, but still,
part of me, I think, in that moment was thinking, well, gosh, this is a great point of empathy, because I'm not gonna necessarily buy into the notion that all Christians, of course, are mass murderers or other things, but I don't think that's what the caller was getting at. It was of course the hypocrisy with which
yes.
we paint other face
absolutely.
With that brush, and who are Christians to do that?
Yeah, and I'd be very very interested to know, John, that how many of these people who accuse Islam of violence, how many of them were against the Iraq war, were using the Christian faith to sort of, you know, to try to sort of, you know, mobilize people against that war, which was such an unjust and unjustifiable war, and how many of them have taken on President Bush in his use of Christianity, and
yeah.
of course he was exactly, and his misuse of Christianity in so many spheres, including, you know, when it came to going to war in the Middle East.
We touched on this theme relative to domestic politics and to some of the hatred that's precipitated out, but this notion of Islam playing a place in the story of Revelation, the rapture, the end times, and other things, and somehow that the way things are playing themselves out and conflict is all part of a plan or something.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that infects a lot of thinking and perhaps a lot of Islamophobia in this country
President Obama being the president of this country.
Yeah,
absolutely. You know, you can't sort of, you know, you'd be branded a racist, and rightly so, if you went after his race. But you can go after him for supposedly for being Muslim,
right?
And it's just disturbing, you know, as to how many people in this country. I've seen figures of, I cite in my book, of 1/4 of this country in a Time magazine poll in 2010. That was when I was working on my book, thought him to be Muslim, and of course, you know, that accounts for at least a part, if not a good part, of the hostility toward him.
Our clock is running down, as you can see, but something we should talk about is of course the Arab Spring. And in my experience, I think you know, one of the questions is, well, why didn't we see it coming? I think perhaps it was because our expectations based on our own Islamophobia were so low. We didn't necessarily think that the people in the Middle East were capable of or were even interested in embracing democratic movements in the way that they are. Does that make sense to you in some ways?
Absolutely. There was the stereotype, yeah. especially of Arabs, you know, being sort of innately authoritarian, not being interested in democracy. While, you know, poll after poll has shown that Arabs are very admiring of Western values such as freedom, such as equality, democracy. It's just U.S. foreign policy that they're critical of,
yeah.
very often. So exactly. I mean, no. Another book that I cite in this in my book is by John Esposito and Dalia Mogahed, which is this poll taken across the Muslim world, which shows this to be true. And, you know, yeah, Egypt, Tunisia especially, were largely non-violent mass movements that got rid of long-standing dictators. Of course, in Syria and Libya, the movements went in a completely different direction. But Egypt and Tunisia are prime examples of where non-violent mass movements did succeed.
Bring this back to the picture of the larger world and, I guess, to domestic politics. I told someone I was going to be tackling this topic this morning who has a pretty sophisticated worldview. He just said, well, good luck. Islam means peace. Trying to convince that to an American people who have been so jaded and so distorted yeah. their opinions. Where do you see this going? Obviously, books like this are important. Telling stories, having people get to know Islamic people are so crucial to it. Are we on an arc that could bend toward justice when it comes to dealing with Islamophobia here?
It would be an extremely long arc.
Okay.
John, but I'm hopeful. You know, seriously, you know, negative feelings toward Islam were going down for a number of years. But in the aftermath of Park 51, that entire Islamic interfaith center controversy in New York City, they've gone up. There's a well-funded Islamophobia industry.
Yeah.
On the right, and they're propagating all this. Part of the problem is media coverage. When there's a violent incident, such as the sort of, you know, horribly regrettable sort of, you know, killing of you know, the U.S. ambassador to Libya, you know, that's immediately conflated with Islam, even though now it quite possibly was the work of a terrorist group and not an sort of, you know, a protest against an anti-Islam movie. So all of these sort of, you know, help perpetuate the image of Islam being intrinsically violent in the minds of Americans. And I think we have a lot of work to do. But, you know, hopefully that's what my book is for, to change minds one at a time.
And we should refer people back in the larger context of your other work and why you're here in Madison as associate editor at the Progressive Magazine. This is a subject that you tackle a great deal, and some of some of your pieces are available online. Is that right?
Progressive.org, and they can search under
yeah.
my name. I've written a lot on this, both in the context of the elections, Islamophobic incidents around the country, in the Muslim world, South Asia. I cover a lot of that, and I have a web column once or twice a week, so they can look those pieces up.
just out of curiosity, I think this happens sometimes, for example, again, to use that analogy, folks who are advocates for gay rights who may not be gay themselves still feel the homophobia, still feel the pressure and everything. As you've been an advocate, you know, on this topic, someone who's not Islamic yourself, do you still in some ways feel a judgment or some of the negative feelings that come out of that? Or?
Absolutely. No, Madison that way is such a wonderful oasis, so not so much here.
Right.
But I went to Florida to talk, and these guys were there from a right-wing group taping my speech, and their motive was if I said anything that they felt was sort of in favor of or in sympathy of, say, I don't know, Hamas or Hezbollah or Al-Qaeda or whichever group they thought I'd be speaking favorably about, that they'd use that to tarnish me, to tarnish the University of Central Florida, which invited me there. So yeah. In other parts of this country, this is very much alive.
Yeah, and we've been very pleased to be speaking with Amit Paul, author of Islam Means Peace, Understanding the Muslim Principle of Nonviolence, today, a week from today at 5:30 at the Overture Center.